Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent. And we're going to focus on property this week because there's been a few noteworthy transactions in that sector, one of which you predicted, one of which you kind of alluded to in one of your alpha roundups a little while back. Let's dive straight in and start with Galliford Try. Galliford Try, a very interesting company. We actually suggested selling its shares a few short weeks ago. And then, of course, there was a potential bid for its home building division this week.
This is something that I alluded to about 5 or 6 weeks ago, that despite the huge mess that this company is in with its construction business, and nobody really seems to know what's going on there, it did have a good asset that other people would like to have, and that is it's Linden Homes house building business.
Yeah, and I think the premise of our sell tip was that not that the Linden Homes business was bad, but that everything else within the group was pretty terrible and could even get worse. And actually, we were speculating before we came into the studio, just what would be left if Galliford Try were you to take Linden Homes out?
Well, this is it, and I think this is the reason. One of the reasons why Bovis's offer, which looks a reasonable offer.
What is it? It's 900.
They offered 950 million in Bovis shares, and then they would take on the £100 million of private placement debt that Galliford has in place. So, total outlay of just over £1 billion.
Which is generous.
It's not bad. You look at these things on net asset value, and looking at Linden's net asset value is a bit complicated because of the way that things are moved around within the company. But they had gross assets, which is essentially mainly the land and the work in progress, of about 720 million at their half year results. So they offered a reasonable premium to that. But I think going back to what you've just said about the whole confusion about what would be left, I think that this is one of the reasons why I think this bid's been rejected, probably because the offer was in shares and not cash, and that essentially if you take away Linden, you could be left with a mess that's bigger than people think it is.
Indeed. So, I mean, just to put the value of the offer in context, the market cap of Galliford Try is just shy of 600 million.
There or thereabouts, yeah.
So the premium offered for just the house building arm over the market cap is, I mean, it's nearly double.
Yeah.
Not quite.
Well, not quite. But the question is, how much are you taking off?
Yeah,
for the construction.
Indeed. And one of the things that the company actually said, which we've mentioned in our tip update, is that one of the reasons that Galliford has rejected the bid is to ensure that it has a viable capital structure. And that would imply to me that it only has a viable capital structure when Linden Homes is included.
In simple terms, if this goes, we're up a creek without a certain paddle,
Yeah. So then and we also speculated on why Bovis hadn't just taken out the whole lot and shut down the construction arm. And that's
probably
another question altogether.
Yeah, I think it's not difficult to come away from this thinking that this must be absolutely horrible.
So these are big long-term contracts, so there's probably a lot of contractual obligation in there, probably some contracts that were under bid or overbid, however you describe it.
Yeah, and then there's cash flow, there's cash moving about all over the place, inflows, outflows. It's a dog's breakfast.
So it's one of those ones. So even though there is corporate interest in part, a big chunk of this business, a very significant premium to the market cap, we've still got the shares on a sell simply because It's as you termed it earlier, it's almost like a poison pill.
I think it is. And the question is what can you get to swallow it? What do you have to take to swallow this? And, you wonder that, maybe a bigger builder, a much stronger financial position, because obviously if you pay with cash for this, you're essentially borrowing money if you're a buyer of this. And house builders probably don't want to be taking on a lot of gearing at this stage in the cycle.
They've been there before.
Not
Emwell.
You know, these businesses are very, very sensitive to changes in prices and volumes of houses sold. And the last thing you really want to be sticking onto a business like this is debt.
Okay, I mean, another question I asked you earlier, which we can perhaps expand upon now, is why does Bovis want to do this?
Well, Bovis has got, you know, had a few problems, and you know, in terms of its reputation, its build quality, and you know, maybe taking on another brand helps sort of diversify away from that a little bit.
And Linden are actually at a slightly more premium end of the market, and actually known as being pretty good quality.
Yeah, it might help Bovis out in terms, but also they may just be able to see it as a good fit with what they've got already. You know, you throw in things like buying efficiencies because you've got more, you get extra buying power, and you think, yeah, I can integrate this into what I've got, get a few efficiencies out of it, and make this kind of deal stack up. I think the interesting thing for me now is whether someone, either Bovis, comes back with a higher offer, or whether somebody else does, and whether it's with cash or not, with the caveat that I've just mentioned. It's a big, you know, it's a big meal for any of the builders, actually. You know, £1 billion of outlay, £1 billion plus. You know, not many of those have got real, genuine cash balances as big as that when you take into account land creditors and...
That's because you're giving it all back to the shareholders.
Cash flows, yeah.
And the directors.
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't seen an awful lot of consolidation in the house building industry so far. Could this be the start of a wave, as you say, as we approach the end of the cycle?
I don't know, is a truthful answer. I think there's an increasing amount of nervousness in this sector, because I think the good times have gone. Mm. The big benefit, the big windfall that they've had through the Help to Buy scheme, and the big uplift they've had by selling, getting higher selling prices on land that they bought very cheaply, that's pretty much washed through now. And now we're getting a situation where you've got cost inflation, materials, labour. You've got builders in the south of England where family houses are pushing right up against the Help to Buy ceiling of 600,000, if not higher than that, which makes them harder to sell. You know, the levels of discount that are having to be offered at that top end of the market. So it's getting difficult.
Should we talk about Telford, who had some numbers this week?
Yeah.
And actually, Telford illustrates how some companies are responding to the rising difficulties, the challenges that house builders face in this sector. It's doing something slightly different, which I know you're keen on.
Yeah, particularly in the south. I mean, if you just to sort of elaborate on the point I was just making, that this £600,000 threshold for the Help to Buy, which has only got two more years to run for all buyers, and then it becomes a first-time buyer only thing, is causing a lot of problems, particularly in London. And Cress Nicholson, one of the high-profile builders that have been caught out by this. And Telford, I think, quite smartly, has chosen to take its business in a different direction. And it is moving away from selling homes to individual private buyers and private investors, and is doing something called build to rent. And this is where it teams up with big investment companies like M&G, Invesco, Legal & General are interested in this sector, who buy the land, and therefore they take out the risk, the selling price risk, and essentially you just become a construction business and you build the houses for the investor. The investor pays a large chunk up front, so you get great cash flow, you get lower outlay, you have a lower outlay. Yes, you earn a lower profit margin from it, but you de-risk the business.
Yeah, how do the margins compare? I think, what do you say here? 13% for the...
They're about half.
Yeah.
So if you look at what... I mean, Telford has been in a bit of a sweet spot in London. It's changed. It's got some quite rich... Last year it had some quite rich mix high value, and it was earning 28% margins, and you're making sort of about 13 on build to rent, but you're not laying out the cash. So you're not laying out the cash for the land. You're just buying the materials and employing the labour, and you're building houses, and then you hand it over to the institutional investor. And this is changing. This is changing the way that the company looks. So you're getting quite a lot of business and turnover coming through, but it's coming through at lower profit. So the profits are coming down a bit, or quite a lot, for Telford. I mean, one of the reasons why the share price has been hammered so much is that they have been held back on the sort of more traditional side of the business, with delays in planning and building out certain schemes, and they're not making as much money as people thought they were going to do, and that's still going to keep going on for the next year or two. So, you know, they were 2 years ago, they were telling investors they were going to make £50 million of pre-tax profit this year, and they're going to make, they've just made 40, and they're going to make a lot less than that next year, and they hope it's going to pick up after 2020.
But if the market's changing, you could arguably look at this company and say, actually, it's doing the right thing. It's kind of jumping before it's pushed into changing direction.
Yeah, and I think it's selling into quite an attractive market underpinned by decent long-term fundamentals, you know, in terms of, you know, you have a lack of affordability to buy in London. You've got a lot of young people who like the flexibility of renting.
And pension funds that want somewhere for their money.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got these three things coming together, and Telford, I think, has been quite smart with this. And it, you know, it makes it a standout company in the sector. Whether the shares are attractive or not, I'm not convinced.
Well, we talked about, you know, in the context of Galliford Try, it's the construction side of things which has proved problematic.
Yeah.
And, you know, one can only assume that the margins there have got, you know,
well,
they're squeezed over
next
time.
To nothing.
Does moving to construction rather than being the house builder itself, you know, the customer facing house builder, does that come with a risk that as more people try to do the same thing, it too will face a margin squeeze over time as a constructor? It's a long-term risk, but one I wouldn't ignore it.
It's possible, but I mean, what I would say against that is that these house building companies have got very good reputations of being good at what they do to a certain extent. Take away all the build quality stories that you've seen in the paper and so on, but they have buying efficiencies. They're plugged into the supply chain.
So I
can't see a normal bog standard construction company coming along and say, well, we're going to build houses now.
It's a specific skill set then that these companies have.
Yeah.
That's Telford have.
Yeah. And I think they're able to sort of give that kind of sort of peace of mind and security and certainty to the end customer, the investor.
Well, the shares certainly look cheap. 11 times forward earnings, nearly 6% yield.
Yeah, the dividend's not growing much, though.
But they're reinventing the business.
It's going to take some time, but they have dangled the carrot and said that they are going to be looking at paying a bigger percentage of their profits out to shareholders. Now, whether that leads to a higher dividend or not, who knows? They may need to do that just to maintain the 17 pence a share that they're paying already. But what it does do is it releases a lot of assets from the balance sheet. So all this land and work in progress will get released, and essentially you probably have to change the way that you look at this. So a lot of people look at builders on the basis of asset value. As this company becomes less asset intensive, you're beginning to look at it more on its earnings and its cash flow stream.
It is interesting. I suspect other house builders will be keeping a close eye on.
I think it's good because if people who understand the house building sector quite well, is that they are essentially geared plays on their land bank. And when the cycle is turning up and prices are turning up, you get a big positive wealth effect to the shareholders, to the business, from rising land prices, from rising house prices. But that also works in reverse. And I like the look of Telford because it's becoming de-risked. So that takes obviously takes upside, but if you think that house prices are getting pretty close to the top and there's more downside risk, this is a share that's quite interesting. The yield on this is getting close to 6% now.
Mm.
It's well covered. Even with a fall in profits next year, it still looks payable. And people will know that I'm not a fan of house builders and I grumble about them a lot, but I'll make an exception for this one.
All right. Worth a look then.
Yeah,
let's stick to property. There's been another transaction this week that I know has caught your eye.
Yeah.
Which was the takeover of A&J Mucklow by London Metric Property.
Yeah.
Now, this, you didn't predict the takeover, but you told our readers, our listeners and our readers of the of Alpha to have a look at this company back in, when was it? February.
Yeah, I think I did garble over this podcast saying that it was a company that I very much liked. Just a nice, steady, conservatively run family property business.
But it stuck out in terms of the things that catch your eye because it's kind of unglamorous and it's sort of northern industrial property.
Midlands.
Yeah. North to me.
Yeah. North to you. South to me.
But yes, so it seems that you were right that there is value in this company that someone else has spotted, London Metric Property.
Well, it was trading at or around or even at a slight discount to NAV, I think, last time I looked at it.
You're right. I've got it here. I think the net asset value at the time of writing was 5.72 per share and the share price was 4.95 per share. So, 13.5% discount to NAV.
And then the other thing as well is this business was also very low geared. So if you take those two things into account, take into account the fact that certain elements of the property market, particularly retail, are pretty horrible right now. Industrial property, warehouses, industrial parks, which Mucklow has made its name and its reputation in. Nice diversifier, good asset, and you can, property guys like property people like leverage, you leverage it as well a little bit without making it too risky. And, you know, the low gearing probably was also quite a factor in this being bought out.
Yeah, so London Metric is interested in expanding its presence to what it calls urban logistics. So I guess this is anything to do with the delivery of stuff to, you know, through e-commerce a lot of the time,
which is,
I guess,
you know, a booming market.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, this is something that we've talked about in our news spotlight this week. There's another little AIM company doing this, Urban Logistics, imaginatively named. But you've also got companies like Seagrow, which have been around a long time, I guess have shifted from pure industrial to more of the supply chain stuff. Tritax, Big Box, REIT.
Any
of these big shed stories.
Lock and Store. You've got another one as well, which is more into storage. But again, it's a diversifier. And you just wonder whether, you know, people will start looking at these, more of these now. I'm very sad. I'm very sad, actually, to see Mucklow go. It's a share I've owned in the past.
In the past.
But obviously, I can't own any shares now, can I?
Is it still in your fantasy sip?
No. It never has been. But I've always thought it's a very sort of safe income play.
I think that's what you said at the time.
And just conservatively managed, as a lot of family-owned businesses are. And there's not many of these that you can get your hands on, really, in the London stock market. So I'm sad to see it go.
Yeah, I mean, it's one less source of income, as you say. And we've obviously discussed that.
To death.
Yeah. I mean, you have actually talked about one company in your column this week, which is a little bit contrarian.
Yeah.
Imperial Brands.
Yeah.
Should we talk about that briefly? Because you also talk about National Grid and SSC. We've talked a lot about their dividends. One, I think you believe is safer than the other. I would tend to agree with that. Read the column to find out which, but you don't have to think too hard to do that. Marks and Spencer's and Sainsbury's you look at and ask the question of whether they can be fixed. I think
they can't.
We put the boot in quite heavily into Marks and Spencer's last week, and I think we should give it a week off of kicking.
We've done enough there.
And Imperial Brands, which surprised me.
This intrigues me, this company, because, you know, I totally get fundamentals, the political risk, the health issues, the ethical issues surrounding this industry.
Well, actually, there was some terrible news from the tobacco industry this week.
Yeah.
And both Bats and Imperial Brands took a bit of a hammering.
Yeah.
This is US tobacco sales data.
Yeah, yeah. It was bad. But I had a look at this. Imperial seems to be doing a reasonable job of ticking along, you know? You think, okay, this is going to eventually fall off a cliff when, you know, maybe no human on earth smokes anymore. But they seem to be doing a good job with these. You know, they have these things called next generation products
and
vapes in plain English. And they seem to be doing all right there. And the profits, you know, these businesses have year after year after year, and this applies to British American Tobacco as well. They're very good at taking cost out. They're very good at getting efficiencies. And, you know, Imperial Brands has, you know, got a fantastic dividend record, and it hiked its dividend by 10% not too long ago when it reported its results. And if you look at the analyst forecasts on this, now analyst forecasts can be wrong, but they're still saying, you know, the profits are going up on this and the dividends are going up. Now, this is a share that's on 7x earnings and yields over 10%.
That's danger territory.
It's covered. You know, it's covered by profits. Okay, about 1.4x. The cash flows are still there. And you've seen a huge amount of institutional selling out of these tobacco companies.
Is that because they don't like the business on its fundamentals, or they're selling because there is this big investor shift towards ESG, environmental, social, and governance?
I think both.
Okay.
And you know, there's always a certain degree of, you know, you feel a little bit uncomfortable talking about, you know, these kind of companies where, you know, the health damage is indisputable. But, you know, I also realise that, you know, there are people listening to this, there are people out there who look for bargains, look for income. And, you know, I'm not, you know, saying that I would buy these myself, but I think that they are...
Moral grounds or...
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I have to admit, you know, if I'm looking at myself in the mirror on this, I think, do I really want to own a cigarette company? I don't. But as part of my job, I look at these companies and I just think, this is absolutely hated, this company. And the income is not only being maintained, the income's going up. Now, unless this thing, I mean, you know, who's to say that the market isn't wrong on this? Could well be spot on that this industry is going to go up in flames.
It's a big enough company for you to think that there will be enough coverage out there for the view to be efficient, as it were.
Yeah, but you can see it in America as well, you know, with like Altria and... Philip Morris.
But there is some pretty onerous regulation being implemented out there, particularly around menthol cigarettes, if I remember rightly.
That's the cloud over British American Tobacco, the menthol cigarettes.
Yeah, but if I remember rightly, these were all always multinational businesses anyway, you know. Obviously, the US was a big market, but...
People are still smoking.
Yeah.
You know, particularly in Asia, emerging markets, and you know, and
I went on holiday to Vienna not that long ago. They love a good old bag out there, and they haven't even banned it indoors.
No, people are vaping. I don't know. All I'm sort of trying to draw attention to here, in a not very articulate or scientific way, is something that just looks incredibly cheap. Now, if you could have held that view for a long time and got absolutely hammered in this. But, you know, 10% yield, there's no dividend, you know, it doesn't look like an imminent dividend cut here. And I mean that for the next 2 to 3 years, you know, dividends going up.
Ugly share price, though.
Horrible.
Falling knife, if ever there was an illustration of a falling knife, that would surely be it.
Okay, but it's a falling knife. But if you're getting 10% yield from here, And let's just say that dividend's maintained for the next 3 years. So even if you don't reinvest, you're getting 30% of your investment back in 3 years.
Yeah, so it's got to fall a bit more and you'd have still made...
I just think from a, you know, an observational point of view, just think, how much lower is this thing going to go? Is this going to yield 15?
Yeah, yeah.
Might.
If they're not going to cut the dividend, it might.
You know? So, yeah, I just thought I'd mention that.
I think it's quite interesting. The hunt for value, not that value has been... Nobody likes value anymore. I think Algie's done his stock screen review this week where he looks at how all of his various screens that he runs throughout the year have done. And value has done very, very, very badly indeed.
And has done for a long time. But I think, you know, I think about this a lot. And I think you just got, if you look at it, you just wonder that eventually something may change on this, because I always encourage people to look at, you know, be like an owner and look at, you know, the cash flows that are coming to you as an owner. And if you look at, you know, the high quality end of the spectrum of the stock market,
which incidentally is the area of screening that has done really very well.
Yeah. So you're buying today, you're getting a very low initial rate of return. So the income you get as a proportion of what you pay, you get a very low yield, free cash flow yield, earnings yield, whatever. You need a lot of growth to start getting the same amount of income than buying, say, more of the value type shares. And I think the thing with value is that there's a lot of poor quality businesses, but there are sort of these middling type businesses where, you know, you look at how much growth I have to get the same amount of income from the expensive share today by buying the cheaper share today. And a really good example that I've used in the past is Fevertree,
which you've written about this week.
Yeah,
actually.
And Britvic, which we talked about on the podcast last week. So Fevertree is on about 40, 45 times forward earnings. So turn that around, your income return on investment's a little bit more than 2%. Britvic's on 15, 16 times or something. So you're getting 6% return as a business owner owning Britvic against 2% owning Fevertree. Just as a business owner, forget about what happens to the share price here. So if I own Fevertree, let's say I own Fevertree and you own Britvic. So we each put £1,000 in each. I'm getting 20 quid, you're getting 60 quid a year. So Fevertree has got to triple its profits for me to get the same amount of income from Fevertree as you get from Britvic now.
Yeah, and from where it is, that looks like a big ask.
Yeah, and this is the kind of thinking that perhaps doesn't quite resonate at the moment, because with shares like Fevertree and lots of other highly rated shares, there's a momentum factor into them. This quality approach, which I am a big fan of, at the right price, is, I think, going too far. There are people out there on Twitter, on the internet, who are blind advocates of quality. They just say, just buy quality, you'll outperform. And they've got plenty of evidence to suggest that that's been the right thing to do in the past.
And there's plenty of very successful funds that have operated that strategy.
Yeah,
they're the ones who you benchmark yourself.
Yeah, yeah, Terry Smith, Nick Train, those people, Keith Ashworth Lord.
I just think about the in their case, they started a long time ago.
Yeah, so their yield on cost is looking quite good. But if you look at going in and buying those kind of shares today, I think that quality is so in vogue now that it's becoming a very, very crowded trade. And you've got to look at where you're going to get, well, you know, ultimately you get your returns as a long-term investor in shares from growth in the income, the profits, the cash flows produced by those companies.
Mm.
And to get these companies to stack up at current valuations, you've got to get a lot of income growth out of it. And I think there's perhaps a certain section of the investing community, I don't know how big, who just believes that this wall of money that's going into this section of the market is going to keep on pushing these prices up, and they're going to get their return through continued share price and PE multiple and expansion and free cash flow yield being forced lower and lower. That might happen, and that is what has happened, but eventually it will stop, because you may get a situation where the real driver of this, the profits and the cash flows of the companies concerned, stop growing or hit a bump in the road. And then you're left in a very difficult position if you're heavily into this kind of thing.
I also wonder whether some of the value screening that we've done, some of the value approach that people have taken is giving value a bad name in some sense, because you're just looking for signs of sort of distress in many cases. You're looking for cheapness and without there being any semblance of underlying quality. Just because something is out of favour doesn't mean it's not a quality company. Just because it's been through a tough time doesn't mean it's not a quality company. But not all cheap companies are good.
No, but I think there's also, I mean, there's also, you know, a few companies out there which sort of catch your eye and think, okay, they're not really top of the quality threshold, and they're not in the real sort of horrible bad business criteria. I mean, I mentioned Britvic. Another one that's produced results this week that I really like is Hollywood Bowl.
Okay, yeah.
And this is a company that I think's really well managed, doing a really good job with its strategy of making these bowling alleys much more family friendly, doing them up, making them nicer places to go. More people are going, they're spending, they're growing their profits, generating lots of cash, paying special dividends. And you can buy Hollywood Bowl on what, 17, 18 times forward earnings?
18 trailing half year.
So 17 and a bit times forward. But you've got, it's, you know, this is a company that's making good return on capital, good profit margins, close to sort of 20% profit margin, good free cash flow margin. And yet it's not like an American tech company or a Fevertree Drinks. And, you know, I look at businesses like that, and I like things like Britvic, which are chuggers, just steady, reliable chuggers. And I'm thinking, if I was putting new money to work, these are the kind of companies that I'd be looking at.
Chuggers.
For want of a better phrase,
I think it's a good one. I've not heard it used in the stock market context before. I think it might catch on.
Who knows? But it's not, you know, it's not all doom and gloom out there.
No.
And, you know, I do have the tendency to stray into that territory.
Don't we all? There's all sorts of reasons for doing that.
There are some fish out there that you might want to try and catch.
Yeah. They're just not the prettier ones, or...
Yeah, nothing wrong with Britvic. You know?
No, nothing at all. Nothing wrong with Hollywood Bowl, apart from the fact that I absolutely loathe bowling. But mainly that's because I'm utterly useless at it. Although my family go, and they go without me.
I'm not a fan, but I also realise that lots of people are.
Yeah, I never understood it.
The finance director of Hollywood Bowl is a really good guy, actually. He's good at... he's quite active on Twitter, and he's very good at communicating with private investors, and, you know, answering questions and that kind of thing in a very decent way.
That's good,
and I think that's always a very good, sign.
Yeah, absolutely. I noticed in the result that we've written up in the magazine that they're opening mini golf centres alongside their bowling alleys. Now, I do like a bit of crazy golf, so... Yeah.
If it's indoors as well.
Yeah, perfect.
You know?
I'm there. And you probably can get a pint at the same time.
He's,
Everyone's a winner.
I think you definitely can have clients at the same time. Nice business.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, it's good to end on a high note, on a positive note. So just to talk you through what else we've got in the magazine, we have Sector Focus, written by our new mining correspondent, Alex Hamer, looking at the mining royalty model, which is a very interesting play on the commodities sector. Lots and lots of results, although it's getting a little quieter now as we head into the summer. Lots in the personal finance and funds section, which they will no doubt talk about on their podcast. Alex Newman has taken a look at the private equity investment industry in this week's further reading column to see how the returns model works there, or doesn't, as the case may be. Lots of news, lots of comments, as per usual. And the cover feature this week is the top 50 ETFs, looking at our annual roundup of all the best ETF options out of the many, many hundreds on the UK market that investors can put a nice little sort of diversified portfolio together from. So thank you, Phil, and thank you all for listening. Pick up the magazine and all good news agents, top 50 ETFs, or get online and subscribe. See you later.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.